Good morning, Oral History Review readers.
Good morning.
This is Yana Kinsmucker. I'm the digital editor of OHR, and joining me today for OHR Conversations is Carrie Hamilton. She's the author of one of our brand new journal articles coming out. It's out online already in the summer-fall 2018 issue, and the hard copies, the printed versions, will be in your mailboxes, I think, any day or week now. It's imminent anyway. And the first article in the issue is Carrie's article called Animal Stories and Oral History, Witnessing and Mourning Across the Species Divide. Carrie Hamilton is an independent scholar. She's a writer and oral historian with a focus on animals, veganism, feminism. And her article touches on a lot of those themes, and it's a really interesting intersection of two subfields. And I'm looking forward in this conversation to learning a little bit more about the field of animal studies and how it can relate to oral history. So that brings me really to my first question for you, Carrie. Can you first describe to our oral history friends out in the world, what is this field of animal studies?
Yeah, so animal studies, I think, is a very broadly defined field. The way I would describe it is that it's a really way of designating a pretty broad set of research going on now across the humanities and social sciences, that are concerned with, I guess, challenging the anthropocentrism, that is, of the humanities, and in this case, and specifically of history, in the case of animal history, and kind of bringing animals into the picture, that is, other than human animals, into the picture and into the analysis as full subjects. So animal studies is very much informed. It's very, very interdisciplinary and necessarily, in most cases, informed by work in the sciences that are most, that are historically more associated with the study of other creatures: zoology, biology, environmental studies, and so on. So there's the kind of, there's that transdisciplinarity, and also I think there's very much interdisciplinarity in the sense of, speaking across different disciplines within the humanities and the social sciences. So you have a real kind of, conversation going through sociology, history, geography, literary criticism, and so on and so forth. And the other thing I should say is that often animal studies actually goes under the rubric of human animal studies, because most typically, and this is certainly the case of my own work in this article, what I'm looking at is the way in which ideas of humanity are both constructed by and disrupted by interactions with other animals. Yeah, so animal studies is a pretty broad field, sometimes called, human animal studies, and also sometimes kind of, spills over into post-humanism, new materialism, and so on and so forth. So I think it's part of a kind of trend in the early 21st century of looking at the other-than-human world from the perspective of humanities and social sciences.
Okay, great. That's a super helpful explanation for those of us who aren't as familiar with the field. It's particularly intriguing that you're bringing animal studies into an oral history together, since obviously we as humans end up speaking for animals, and in such an oral medium and an oral discipline where we're interested in stories. I'd like to think about, I liked how you were contemplating the role of animals within an oral history interview. Can you describe some of the ways an animal can impact an interview as it's happening?
Yeah, I mean, I first got interested in this question of how animals appear in oral history when I was doing a rather kind of obvious set. I was listening to and writing about actually a more a very obvious set of interviews preoccupied with the theme, which was that there's the British Library here in London, British Sound Archive, has a collection of interviews done with animal rights activists and animal welfare activists from Britain who were done in the late 90s and early turn of the millennium. And so listening to those interviews, of course, animals came in every way. They were the center of people's lives and activism, but in some lit, and so they were, the stories were full of animals, but also there were animals literally present in the interview space. So I became quite aware, as an oral historian who's been interested in the past with how the interruption of other human beings into an interview can shape the way the narrator tells the story. I mean, you're probably familiar with, you know, all of the usual instructions we get as oral historians is to get into a silent space where there is minimal noise disruption and certainly no other, you know, humans or animals coming and interrupting with their, you know, requests for a cup of tea or their barking or their mummy, I want some milk or whatever. And I had been in situations where this was just not possible, as I'm sure most interviewers have at some point. I mean, I did interviews in Cuba, for example, that were just constantly being interrupted because there's very little in the way of a kind of private silent space because of the housing situation in Havana, for example. So there were constant dog barking, children, neighbors crying, phones ringing, cars going by, and so on and so forth. So that really shapes the way you listen to the interview and analyze it. I've done interviews with parents talking about their time in prison in which their children were walking in and out, and that really informed how the interviewer was talking about their history. So I thought, you know, in spite of these well-intentioned instructions that are handed down to us to seek this kind of private, you know, space, silent space, this is constantly being interrupted and therefore kind of becomes part of the interview itself. And then the animals are yet another example of that. So I was really interested in the way, for example, with some of these British interviews that I had been listening to a few years ago, the way in which animals coming into a space really gave a sense of a kind of kinship with the animals across species. So then I went and did some interviews in Spain with members of Spain's first animal welfare organization, which was founded just after the dictator Francisco Franco died in 1975. This organization called ADA, which is Association for the Defense of Animal Rights, was founded in 1976 in Barcelona. And so I was able to find one person still kind of living and around in that area. The focus of this particular interview that's about to be published in History Review, and I did an interview with her at the organization's current offices in Barcelona, and I called this one up. And we didn't have animals in the interview space, but what absolutely fascinated me about it was that not only did her discussion of her activism with this organization of course bring in a number of other animals, the most obvious ones in the Spanish case, not surprisingly, being bulls, because of the ongoing, you know, long-term concern with ending bullfighting, which is still legal in Spain, but also just her day-to-day life. I mean, her kind of life story was just full of these memories of other animals. And the main ones that came up were, you know, in one case, very predictable. That was the family dogs, a series of dogs she'd had in her life. But the other one, less predictable, which is her relationship to pigeons. And so I find this kind of really compelling, because pigeons are not really usually the first animal that most people think of when they think about animal rights, and indeed they don't feature very strongly, whereas, you know, dogs, domestic animals, and, you know, big fauna like bulls do. So I just became really interested in the way in which, you know, even though the interview was naturally geared towards talking about human-animal relations, this was a, you know, long-time animal welfare activist, nonetheless, animals came in rather unexpected ways, and I think, and told me a lot about the way in which this woman had developed a kind of philosophy of life and the way her day-to-day living generated around interspecies relationships in a way that I hadn't really come across in oral history, neither that I'd done nor read about, and so that's what got me interested in it.
Okay. So, And this sort of leads up to my next question, which you had a really fascinating sort of theoretical discussion of, whether animals have a history and what kind of agency, historical agency, animals have. Say that they leave behind no so-called traditional sources, and they are always sort of being mediated and represented by the humans in relationship with them. So how do animals have a history or have historical agency?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really interesting because it touches on so many issues that are, you know, the way in which history and oral history has been influenced, for example, as we know, in the last 20, 30 years by, you know, post-structuralist thought and the whole question of representation. So, I mean, on the one hand, you have the whole question of whether any historical subject, human subject, whether we have any kind of direct access to any human subject, even a speaking subject, it touches on questions of memory and so on. So on the one hand, there's that aspect of it, that, you know, we just further expand our critical thinking around the creativity that is required and the kind of, you know, theoretical leaps of faith that we need to make when talking about subjects in the past. On the other hand, of course, we have this question of language. I mean, we speak as oral historians to other human beings, you know, even if we don't share a shared human language, we can translate and interpret and so on and so forth. You know, and even if dogs, you know, bark in an interview, the interpretation is a rather different interpretation than the interpretation of Spanish or Catalan or whatever, or English would be. But there's been a real change in thinking around this, I would say, over the last 15 years as this field of, you know, the history of human-animal relations or animal history develops. And a key figure in this is a British historian by the name of Erica Fudge, who's written, I think, some of the most interesting things, reflections on animal history. And Fudge asked a question about, you know, 20 years ago, this very question, can animals have a history and really know what we're talking about is a history of human attitudes towards animals, precisely because of this question that, you know, animals don't leave these conventional sources, nor do they have a kind of sense of periodization, the way in which we do as humans, a way in which historians kind of impose retrospectively periodization on history. Animals don't do that. And there is a danger here, obviously, anthropomorphizing animals and kind of giving them a human history and making them into humans. And that has started to change, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is that I think that the general kind of expansion of environmental history and concern about the Anthropocene and a kind of realization that human beings have been made a bit of a mess of our relationship to the planet, and that the planet is now changing, the climate is changing, partly thanks to our actions, but also in ways that we don't have any control over. And so there are now, you know, interesting articles in history about, you know, even not inanimate objects having agency, you know, and thinking kind of more broadly about that. And with animals, I mean, I think it's very clear that people do, there's all sorts of research in mythology, ecology, and zoology. People watching, you know, mostly larger animals, primates, domestic animals, and so on. And, of course, writing about the fact that animals do things of their own accord. We're not thinking, you know, Descartes, who famously or infamously said that animals were machines that had no kind of, you know, consciousness. They only reacted. They didn't act. It has been really proven wrong. And so I think as thinking evolves in the biological sciences around animals and their, you know, capacity to do all sorts of things, even though they don't share our language to communicate it in, that then influences history. So historians have become quite creative in combining kind of contemporary evidence of animal agency and reading historical sources through that evidence. And so the example that I gave in this interview actually was in relation to pigeons. So, you know, Doris talks about all these stories about how the pigeons come to visit her, they stay on her balcony and she feeds them and so on and so forth. And that might, you know, seem like a very kind of typical, rather banal thing to do. But interestingly, I did find some very recent studies on pigeons in urban areas, which have proven that in the wake of a real kind of shift over the last 100 years in human attitudes towards pigeons, who used to be seen as, you know, doves, which they are, very friendly animals, to being seen as rats with wings. And now, you know, pigeons get a lot of grief. You know, people throw things at them, they tease them, there are policies to try to exterminate them, they're seen as a plague and so on. And there have been studies now that have concluded that pigeons know now how to identify friendly human beings and unfriendly human beings. They gravitate towards human beings who are, of course, who are likely to feed them, but also who are likely to be more, you know, friendly and less aggressive towards them. So actually, that's an example of how pigeons not only kind of adopt, but, you know, change their behavior in relation to humans. And in other words, they have agency. They don't just react to things that humans do. They have agency. In a sense, there's also the big debate about whether we can get over our obsession with agency as being, you know, attached to individual rational choice, and whether we can understand, you know, the kind of talents that pigeons, I mean, pigeons obviously have many other talents, you know, like all birds do, that we don't share as human beings. So I think that's, I think it's still in the very early days of historians thinking about how to look for animals in sources. And I think it's overwhelmingly true right now that we kind of find traces of animals through their human representations. And that's where perhaps animal history starts to overlap with all those histories of human beings who also, have left rather kind of incomplete, ephemeral traces in the historical record because of power relations among human beings. And, you know, the vast majority of human beings, as we know, have left little, if any, record. So I think animal history is inspired a lot then by, you know, women's history, post-colonial history, working class history, to kind of think creatively with sources. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, I can see how that trajectory would occur. Makes a lot of sense. So how then do you think your use of oral history, and my understanding is you've been an oral historian for quite some time and worked on a number of projects, now bringing oral history to animal studies shaped your understanding of both animals and of the field of animal studies. What do you think oral history brings?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, one of the most interesting things that, and this is why I think that it would be interesting for other oral historians to start asking questions, more questions about the lives, the animals in people's, in their subjects' lives, because animal studies is very much influenced by kind of, you know, philosophical and theoretical thinking on animals and their relationships with humans. And particularly for historical reasons, you know, the big philosophers associated with animal rights and animal liberation, Peter Singer, who, you know, his book Animal Liberation, published in 1975, you know, is an absolute, you know, kind of one of those few academic books that has kind of changed history, founded a political movement. And even though Singer is, you know, especially he's a utilitarian philosopher, so, you know, that's not really a philosophy that a lot of kind of, you know, contemporary people into, you know, continental philosophy would support. But nonetheless, he has been massively influential. And he's also been massively influential among activists. I mean, people who have an interest in animals often cite Peter Singer. What's interesting about Peter Singer? Peter Singer, to speak to him himself, or at least what he's written, certainly in the introduction to Animal Liberation, that he's not very interested in animals as individuals. He didn't love animals. He's very, very critical of people who claim to love animals in some kind of sentimental way. He was particularly scathing in Animal Liberation in a very sexist way, of kind of little old lady animal lovers who had, you know, petted their cats and dogs while they were eating ham sandwiches. I mean, he really was into getting away from those kinds of contradictions. Now, that kind of prejudice has actually spilled over very much into animal studies. So you get people saying, okay, you know, this problem with animal rights activists is they're not really interested in animals in any concrete way. They only have an abstract interest in animals as sentient beings and kind of, you know, who we should, in some kind of moral way, you know, we have a moral obligation towards, but we don't have to treat them with kind of care and love. Oral history is a very good kind of source to show that people can kind of, on the one hand, be very committed to Singer's philosophy of animal liberation and can be very active in the, you know, the kind of moral cause of animal liberation, at the same time as they are absolutely 100% committed to their animal kin, the animals that are closest to them, their cats, their dogs, their rats in the case of some, the pigeons and so on. So that's just one example where I think, you know, injecting a bit of the kind of complexity that oral history comes up with, because oral history, like sociology, like anthropology, it just picks up no end of the complexities and often, you know, seeming contradictions that people's lives, that people's lives involve. And I think that some of that kind of real life messiness, to use the term that Donna Haraway, the posthumanist scholar who's really also very much influenced animal studies, has talked about, is those kind of day-to-day interactions that human beings have with the animals in their lives. It teaches us a lot about, you know, the role of the role of animals in you know, in human society that isn't summed up usually in more kind of abstract thinking around animals and human-animal relations, even though that's also very important. So that's, to me, that was one of the themes that started developing, is that, yeah, sure, you might come across the odd animal rights or animal welfare activist who doesn't care about animals. I certainly haven't. And the way in which I think human beings negotiate those day-to-day realities in their activist lives, I think that's one of the things that, you know, especially those of us who are interested in oral history, the oral history of political activists, you know, like to be reminded that, you know, what you read in the philosophy of animal rights is not necessarily what's happening on the ground in the lives of animal rights activists. So that's, I think, one of the most interesting.
Sure, and that's, yeah, really aspects. Really what oral history is so effective at across every topic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the wonderful contribution to the Oral History Review. Again,
thank you.
That article is Animal Stories and Oral History, Witnessing and Warning Across the Species Divide, and you'll find that in the summer-fall issue that just came out online and will be in your mailboxes before you know it. Carrie, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much. The pleasure is mine.